All right, this is Charlie Flynn McKeever, Artistic Director and Co-Founder of North Carolina Stage Company. I am sitting down to speak with the director of Jeeves at Sea. She is a formidable director of plays, many at our theater at North Carolina Stage Company, including all the other Jeeves plays that we've done. This season's Frost Nixon, as well as Angels in America and countless others. She is the co-founder of North Carolina Stage Company and my favorite person, Angie Flynn McKeever.
Hi.
Hi. So we're sitting here in our, she's my favorite person because we're married. Also the mother of our children. We're sitting here in our kitchen, Angie and me and our dog, Ollie, who's just settled into the couch to watch us do this. And we're just going to sit around and talk a little bit about Jeeves at Sea and some other things. We're also going to balance our checkbook, check in on the family budget, I'm sure, at some point during this conversation. Maybe not. But, so thanks for sitting down with me, Angie. I sent you some questions earlier. First of all, like, what is Jeeves about, in particular this Jeeves at Sea play that we're doing?
The Jeeves stories all have a number of elements in common, and Jeeves at Sea is no exception. We always have Jeeves and Bertie Wooster. Bertie, of course, is the gentleman about town. He is a wealthy bachelor living in London, and these stories are mostly set in the 20s and 30s. And Jeeves is his valet, his incomparable, very smart, what they say is a gentleman's gentleman. Mm-hmm. And Bertie and Jeeves really come from a long tradition of a wise master, wise servant and foolish master tradition. You see this through centuries of different kinds of plays.
And like like Shakespeare has them? Or
well, more of it. It's a comic trope, right, that mm-hmm. is revisited a lot. And, excuse me. And so these plays all, and the stories, of course, these are all based on the P.G. Woodhouse stories and short stories and novels. And Jeeves at Sea is a combination, as most of the other Jeeves plays are, a combination of a couple of different stories that the playwright, Margaret Rather, took elements from these different stories and put them together into really a new confection. So in this installment, we see Jeeves and Bertie, they're on a yacht. They are in Monaco, and they are there in enjoying themselves. As always happens at the beginning of these stories, everything seems to be fine, but very quickly something happens to throw a wrench into this perfect day that Bertie is having. In this case, it takes the form of a very intimidating Austrian count, his very hapless friend who is called Crumpet, and the young woman whose father's yacht they are on, Lady Stella Vanderly, and her paid companion, Miss Pilbeam. So the way that these six characters combine and the different things and scrapes that they get into, the elements of it are familiar the way they are combined and recombined by Woodhouse himself and now by Margaret Rather, the playwright, are what makes them both familiar and delightful.
Right. There's always some like scrape he's getting in, right, with, and it's usually about a woman that he's mm-hmm. Either gotten mixed upedly connected with, or his aunt is mm-hmm. Trying to get him. Mm-hmm. And this one is a little different because the woman seems to be a little more on equal footing in terms of a mischievous nature. And
yes.
Her name is Stella.
Right.
Played by Corinne
Metzger.
And I remember reading this to begin with and going, oh, look, Bertie's kind of met his match. And I was mm-hmm. talking to Margaret Rather yesterday on a different matter. And I was just, we were both noticing how the love interest character in this particular iteration of Jeeves has a what I was saying earlier, this equal footing in terms of, well, I guess, is it mischievous or is it, no, she's really, you know, she pushes some action almost intentionally, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I would say she is much smarter than Birdie. And unlike the women in the other plays that we've done, she doesn't want anything from him. She doesn't need him. She doesn't need Birdie.
Like some of them need him to change and they need,
yeah,
need
they, someone. She doesn't have an agenda as far as Birdie is concerned.
Right.
And so that's really different. She's much more of what we would think of as more of a modern woman. She has her own money. She has her own things that she wants to do. And Birdie's kind of along for the ride, which is a very different dynamic than what we've seen before.
We have this new-ish character in Miss Pilbeam. Mm-hmm. And I suppose she is sort of a proxy of the austere
aunt,
aunt, yeah, that tries to make everybody behave,
right,
the way she thinks they should. But she's, is there anything like different? I mean, there are these things that you describe as tropes, or what do we call them? They're almost stock characters.
That's right.
In a way, yeah, which is a very French thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what is there anything different about this particular character of, you know, who serves that function?
Well, yes. I mean, I would say the huge thing that's different about Miss Pilbeam from her counterparts in earlier plays is that she doesn't really have any power. So while she has this force of her moral understanding of how people should behave, unlike Aunt Agatha and Aunt Dahlia, who we've seen in previous plays, they're not related to Birdie. I mean, they are related to Birdie, so they can tell him what to do. They can threaten him in different ways. Aunt Dahlia's threat with Birdie always is, if you don't do this thing that I want you to do, I'm not going to invite you to my country home to eat my French chef Anatole's cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And so Birdie always comes around. They always have something over him. Whereas Miss Pilbeam, you know, and British social class is a big sub theme in this play. She is not of the same class. And for that reason, she doesn't have power over Birdie.
But you know what? She does have power over him. I realized as you were talking, because Jeeves kind of has a romantic interest in her. We find this out in the first 5 minutes of the
right.
play. So that is a little bit of a power over him. Not that she's wielding, but
right.
that her situation has. So it's the difference
right.
between something
a...
that's you could describe as malevolent or intentional, and this is, you know, situational.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
good point.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's this sort of the dramaturgical element of the stories is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Now that leads me to another question. So like there's a particular style of play this is. I mean, it's kind of a farce, but it's also not. It's a comedy of manners.
And a language play in a lot of ways.
Language play. Mm-hmm. But there's a, you know, I was talking to Margaret again yesterday, and I was saying how in the play we did last year, Jeeves takes a bow on who's it? The really bad one? Aunt Agatha. Aunt Agatha is not there, but she has a presence in... you feel her presence with
right.
the way the characters respond to her, even if she's like just writing a letter to them. But
right.
then another character comes in who is a proxy for her in the sort of austere, judgmental way of Birdie. And that's the big thing about the judgmental
right.
part of it. And I was just saying how, like, you know, she was saying to me that she tries to keep the number of characters to a manageable number so that theaters will be more likely to produce it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could have Aunt Dahlia or Aunt Agatha come in as well as the characters that she's with. But she's able to, I think one of the skills that Margaret has as the adapter is that she can whittle these stories
mm-hmm.
down to, a new thing, like you were saying earlier, a new situation, but also keep the spirit of a character alive, even if she's not using it right. in the play.
I think that's right. I mean, I think what she's really great at is distilling the different forces that are at work, right? So there's the romantic force, and there's the catalytic force, and there's the obstacle force. And it doesn't have to be all these different characters. It can be an amalgamation.
Right, right. So in terms of the style of the play, like we were talking about a minute ago, does that present certain challenges that... So you directed Frost Nixon earlier this year, and mm-hmm. that is one of those plays that has a lot of dramatical elements, but it's done in shortish scenes with some long set scenes in there. And then that's different than, say, a play like, I don't know, what have you directed recently that is more just people in a room? You know, there's that kind of character.
I did Dial In for Murder out at Flat Rock Playhouse.
Right, and that takes place in one place. It's a couple of scenes.
Right, but they're long scenes, very right. long scenes.
And Frost Nixon is more cinematic. As the years have gone on, plays have become more cinematic. In fact, the playwright of Frost Nixon is first and foremost a screenwriter.
Right.
So that really shows up in his plays. But this play is its own kind of animal.
Right.
In that there are certain ways the actors are needing to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find it's like looking at the situations the characters find themselves in, trying to find some kind of some real mm-hmm. or tangible things that they are trying to get.
Yep.
Some needs they're trying to fulfill.
Yep. It's funny that you say that, because we were working on a scene today with two of the characters, and I don't want to give anything away because this is deep in the third, you know, towards the last sort of quarter of the play. But what we were finding was these two characters really have intense needs for each other, and the stakes are very high. They have very high romantic stakes mm-hmm. in the scene. And we were trying all these different ways of playing it, just because it's rehearsal and that's what you do. You try lots of different things out. And at one point, we'd gone through it several times. And at one point, at the end of the scene, we all kind of looked at each other and said, wow, that kind of turned into Chekhov there, didn't it? And they were kind of looking at me disturbed. I was like, no, this is the right thing to do, right? We find this emotional truth. We find what's at stake for the characters. And then we have to put it back into the style of the play. We have right. to put those two things together. So we're not going to do it that way, but it's worth doing that work so that we can, so that we're not just playing for laughs. Because
right.
that's not the job.
Associate plays like this in sort of the no holds barred way you have to go at it.
Sure.
In the playing of it, even in rehearsal. Like you can't necessarily plan out how you're going to do stuff
right
prior to getting into rehearsal, but if you can get in the mindset of Wile E. Coyote
mm-hmm.
right, and then you're, you know, you're running off the cliff, and or, you know, you're still running until you realize there's no ground below
right.
you, and then you fall
right.
So are there any particular, like, when you're working with actors and directing the play, and you've talked a little bit about the situations of the characters and the needs that they're mm-hmm. trying to fulfill. What about some purely technical things, right? So
mm-hmm.
I've been in rehearsal where you've said, I think it's going to be funnier if we do this on the third time or something
right.
like that. And, what's that like to work on, mm-hmm. With this particular group of people?
I have a couple answers to that. One is, I mean, with this particular group of people, it's incredibly easy because this is the fourth one of these that we've done. So I can say to Scott, oh, wait, don't do that. Don't do it till the next line. And he knows exactly what I'm talking
right,
about.
Right, right.
There are a couple other things that I think come up with a play like this. One is that I've done this kind of thing now, you know, I mean, I've been directing professionally for a long time and I've done plays like this enough now to just, you just have an instinct. You just have, oh, no, 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 do it this way. You know, wait, don't move on that, move here. And the actors all have even better instincts than I do because they embody it. I'm just looking at it. But then the other side of that is, sometimes you know that the funny thing is there, but you can't find it yet.
Right.
And so part of my journey as a director has been not pushing that and just saying, I'm sketching this in for now. I don't know what this is going to be yet, but we're going to find it. And knowing that through the process, that thing is going to reveal itself.
All right. So what is the when you're rehearsing a play, what are things that you particularly like, the favorite parts of working on a play?
Like a play like this or just in general?
Let's start here and then, you know.
I guess my favorite parts are when it just feels like everything is clicking along and everybody in the room is on the same wavelength and we're all, like one of my favorite things is when there's some, we're all trying to solve some problem. It's, we need to end up here, but there's no good way to get there. Or this needs to work this way. And that the getting to lead a group of people to creatively problem solve is really fun for me. That is the reason I direct. That is the whole process for me. So I love it when those things happen. And that's true no matter what kind of play it is.
Right. It's just different.
It's just different. The kind of problem solving is different.
Yeah. What about dislike? What are things that you?
There's not anything I dislike. I think one of my a part of the process I don't love is the part that is going to happen about 5 days from now when everybody's trying really hard to get off book.
Uh-huh.
And I'm kind of useless at that point. There's not. I can't really direct very much when people are just trying to remember their lines.
Yeah. What do you have to do to prep for something like this? So like, there are some logistical things. Like for example, I was telling Margaret yesterday that I'm hiding in a big crate mm-hmm. on the deck of the ship. She went, oh, that's clever. You know, I mean, it's not in the script.
Right.
That's a logistical thing
right.
that we put in there so that, you know, I think one of the things our theater has to do is adapt in terms of our physical space is limiting right. in some ways.
Right.
And so we needed to find a place where we could, you know, there's no place to hide on stage. It's just right. everything's right there. So there are logistical things, and then there are like those stylistic things we were talking about a minute ago that sort of get your head in the game,
right? Right?
So Frost Nixon, I know you listen to
Slow Burn
podcast. You watch the interviews. You did some reading too.
I did a lot of reading. I watched a bunch of stuff about Watergate and Nixon. I prepped for Frost Nixon in a really different way than I prepare for the Jeeves plays.
Right.
So it was just a really different animal. The cast was much bigger. There was the multimedia aspect to it that I needed to plan out ahead of time. And with this play, it's really more about thinking through what some of these problem-solving moments are going to be. There's always stuff that you can't predict, or at least that I can't predict. So you can't catch everything, but I try to think about that stuff ahead of time. And mostly for me with something like this, it's about just getting in the right frame of mind to be a good leader for the group. It's not so technical or logistical.
Yeah. You find yourself like pumping yourself up before rehearsal? Or like you're in a bad mood and you're like, I gotta get my head right.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes yeah. I have to like turn off everything in the car and just think about, you know, when I'm driving to rehearsal, just think about like how do I need to show up in the room today?
Do you have any song that's like, you know, your game face song?
I don't.
No?
I don't. I have game face silence.
No. Okay.
But I'll
you know,
think
like
about
the
it.
Like the power song that gets you through that last.
That's for when I'm nervous. I don't get nervous to go to rehearsal.
Oh, all right. Well, what do you listen to when you're nervous?
Sometimes I listen to Africa.
I hear it rains.
It does.
I think do you listen to like Bon Jovi or anything like that?
Sometimes. I mean, I have a playlist that I might
So we, do you listen to your headphones at the gym, like when you're really in your free gym?
I do not.
Time?
No?
No. Oh, I can't work out without hearing.
Well, there's always something. Music playing at the gym.
Oh, right. You go to a young person's gym.
I do.
So let's use that moment to segue to the intersection of your personal life and work life. But also, there's a third part there of your business that you do. Insight, right? What's the name of your business? Excite?
Ignite. Maybe you want to go back to that first part of the question.
What was the first part of the question?
About my personal life, which I think had to do with being married to you.
Right. What?
I would think you would know the name of my business.
I know the name of your business.
You have a t-shirt that has it on there.
Ignite. So tell me, what does Ignite do?
We are a company that coaches people to talk to other people. And that means lots of things. It means keynote speeches, presentations, how to run meetings, how to have difficult conversations, how to...
Like this one.
No, not like... Well, it could be. Media training. We do media training. We do how to talk to, like, stakeholder meetings. How do you talk to people who may have a very strong opinion about something that the organization that you represent is doing? We do lots and lots of group workshops and individual coaching, and we work all over the country.
And so you're sort of putting that on hiatus right now, right? I mean, you work... You do development work.
I do all of my work all the time.
But you're not traveling and doing stuff.
I am not traveling in January.
Right. So there's that. And then now we have a 16-year-old daughter who just got her license, which is
awesome.
Easing up some of this because she was able to take our son to basketball practice today.
Huge.
And it means we didn't have to schedule around
dropping him off, right?
Yeah. But I know there have been times in the past where we've just been, I know, constantly driving after school and then arriving at rehearsal.
Yep.
Do you recall any, like, particularly heinous situation where...
Yes.
Which one?
Well, you were in Moonlight and Magnolias, I think. Like 2007?
Yeah. Sounds right.
7 or 8.
Uh-huh.
And I was driving to the Asheville airport to go on a business trip.
Oh, I remember this.
And you call Rebecca Morris, a wonderful actor who also was working for us at that time as our nanny, could not come to work that day. And you were sick.
I remember.
And both of our kids were in preschool.
Oh, yeah.
You were so sick. You had the flu.
I was so sick.
And you called me and I was in the car and you were like, what am I going to do? Rebecca can't come to work. And I was like, I... don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Call friends.
I don't remember what I did.
I think Sarah Repley came over.
Oh, really?
That's my memory. Anyway, but that was a bad one because that was like, I have to go get on this plane. I cannot not get on this plane.
Right. Yeah.
It was about this time of year. It was February. And it was 2008, actually. And I was going up to Washington.
Oh, I was sick as a dog.
I felt so bad.
Yeah.
I felt so bad.
Now, mind you, I was not calling you. As I recall it, I wasn't calling you to say, help me.
Come home. No, you just didn't know what to do.
It was, I need your advice.
Right,
yeah.
That's right.
Okay. And we came up with call Sarah and get her to come over,
yeah.
I think. So that, fortunately, that worked out. And then, I guess another part of it, so I've been wondering, like, when you schedule rehearsals, first you look at everybody's schedule, right?
Yes.
And so... we are a professional theater, but almost everybody we work with has other responsibilities,
right.
Like maybe another job. They have
right.
kids, school. I know Scott Treadway has to, you know, get home by 2:30 or so,
yeah.
or needs to leave by 2:30 in order to pick his daughter up from school. And then there are the business things, and I have meetings at work and board meetings, things like that. But how much influence does the North Carolina basketball men's basketball team schedule play into your scheduling? Obviously not that big of a deal yesterday as they were playing Pitt, but
I mean,
did you schedule anything around the Duke game?
I.
Or do we not have the Duke game till we open?
Oh, the Duke game is after we open.
Oh, which means I'm in the show while the Duke
game. So I have on. The way I schedule is I have
totally. Do.
I do all the French scenes, which for those who are listening, French scenes are the exact page numbers of who's on stage at what time. So page 11 to 13 is Jeeves and Birdie. And then from, you add Crumpet from 14 to 16. So you break it down really granularly so you know who you need when. So I have that done. And then I know essentially how many hours I want to rehearse and how it's all going to break down day by day. And then, like you said, I have people schedule conflicts. So I have that all in a spreadsheet. And then my other window that's open is the Tar Heel schedule.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I do what I can. We don't have rehearsal Tuesday night. There's a game that I'd like to watch.
For those of you, listening, my wife is an avid college basketball fan now. She was not 3 years ago, but she has,
I was 3 years.
Not 4 years ago, right. But yeah. My family, I guess, has turned her on to Carolina basketball, and we watch that. My dad teaches at Carolina, and I and my three siblings all have at least one degree from UNC Chapel Hill. So that takes up a big deal of our bandwidth on game days. Let me segue to another question. It's a multiple choice answer.
Okay, ready.
What's it like working with your husband? A, is it great, or B, is it the greatest?
That's not really multiple choice.
it's two choices.
I would say working with my husband is the greatest.
There you go.
There are moments where we butt heads.
I think that's all we needed to hear.
There are moments where we butt heads.
I still have a bruise from one the other day.
But we tend to work it out.
That's all you're going to say on it?
Well, I thought you had heard enough of that answer.
You can elaborate if you want.
I mean, I think the thing that I value the most about working with you is that you have an eye for certain things that I don't always. And I think that's why you and I have really great complementary skill sets. And there are plenty of times when I'm directing something that you're not in, and it's really helpful to me. I will say, I can't crack this. What do you think? And you always have great insight about that. To me, that gets more clouded when you are one of the people who I'm directing, because right. Your style, the way you like to work, is really different from the way I like to work. And so that's why we butt heads.
It's almost like there's a Venn diagram, and usually the shaded in portion, which each part shares, is like the good thing.
Right.
But I think our Venn diagram, that little shaded section, is like
beware. Right.
What's going on? All right.
Well, maybe fourth time is a charm. Maybe we'll get this through this one with unscathed.
No. It's all good. I think that's just about it. Anything else you want to bring up?
I was just going to say, I mean, I've probably said this before, but the Woodhouse books and short stories are a huge part of my understanding of comedy and a real, it's like the epitome to me of my Anglophilia and my love of that type of British humor. And it dates back to when I was, 12 or 13. And I, you know, one of my favorite things actually about directing these plays is when we talk about them, you meet other Woodhouse fans. And it takes no time at all before you're both laughing, talking about, oh, and this one, and the, you know, and it's just a wonderful, thing to get to share with people.
How did you know that was funny? Is that, like, so you're reading, you got the books when you were like, what'd you say, 12
seventh
or 13?
Grade, yeah.
Seventh grade? And you started reading them, and they just, like, clicked with you.
Yeah, the first one I read was Carry On Jeeves, which is short stories.
Because it's so dry.
Very.
You know? And I can imagine, you know, kind of going over a seventh grader's head, almost, as they're reading it. Like, it's one thing to have actors...
Right.
know that it's supposed to be that way and deliver a line a certain way, you know, but I don't know. I can't imagine myself as a seventh grader like getting it. I did watch a lot of Monty Python.
That wasn't the way in for me. I mean, yeah. I was always a big reader. Just knowing some of the conventions of how British people write helped a lot. I think, I mean, I had read a ton of C.S. Lewis. There were just all kinds of, I'd read a lot of British authors before I came across P.G. Woodhouse. So I think I was primed for it.
Well, the thing I most relate to it is the Blackadder series, right. Which is, I think, it's close to it, mm-hmm. in terms of, I don't know, the way the characters are totally not self-aware, and there's one character, right. who is self-aware.
Right.
In those particular ones, the wise person is also a foil for a lot of the comic things that, right. happen. What's his wagon? What's his name?
Rowan Atkinson.
Rowan Atkinson, yeah. And then Hugh Laurie and the, right. other guy.
Stephen Fry,
who ended up doing the roles of, right. Bertie and Jeeves for the BBC series.
Yeah. Well, now Stephen Fry is a writer as well and writes very much in that same, I mean, it's not Woodhosian, but it's...
Say Woodhosian again.
I don't know if that's correct, actually.
I double dare you.
It's probably Woodhovian or something.
Woodhovian? Well, all I know is I gave you the new book. What's it called?
Jeeves and the King of Clubs.
So, and who's the author?
I think his name's Ben Schott, Schott.
And so he obviously got permission from the estate
mm-hmm.
to write a new Jeeves and Worcester adventure.
Yes.
And it's a whole novel, right?
It's so
just
good.
One story?
Yes.
Right, not a collection of stories?
No.
and you're in bed as we're trying to go to sleep the other night, just giggling.
Well, and that to me, and I think I said this to you at the time, that to me is the mark of a great Woodhouse. It's like, it doesn't matter who's in the room with you. You have to stop what you're doing and read. Like, you just have to listen to this. It's so funny.
Well, you don't have to go sleep with us in the same room while Angie's reading portions to me to get this play.
No,
you can come to the play and actually forego, yes. that entire awkward.
You sure could. Thing. In fact, probably should.
Yeah. And come see Jeeves at Sea at North Carolina Stage Company, running late January and into February. I don't know the dates. I don't have any of that stuff.
Let me look on our fridge.
What's on our fridge?
The brochure.
Angie's going over to look at our
postcard. January 23rd to February 17th.
January 23rd to February 17th, Wednesday through Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 2. And then we have some additional Saturday matinees, which you can find out more at our website, www.ncstage.org, or you can call the box office at 239-0263 anytime on the weekdays between noon and 5 and ask for information. And I want to thank you for sitting down with me, Ange.
Of course.
All right. Hope to see you at the theater.
Bye.
Bye.